Commerce will host their 110th annual dinner on Thursday, January 14th at 6 p.m. at the Renaissance Vinoy Resort and Golf Club. This year's highly anticipated event sponsored by SunTrust will feature the combatant commander of U.S. Central Command, General David H. Petraeus. Don't miss your opportunity to hear from this well-decorated hero and great military leader on Thursday, January 14th. Individual tickets are $80 and can be purchased by calling 727-388-0685 or log on to business.stpete.com.
The content of the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic is for informational purposes only. The content is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you have heard on the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare show. If you think you may have a medical emergency, call your doctor or 911 immediately. Focus on Females does not recommend or endorse any specific tests, physicians, products, procedures, opinions, or other information that may be mentioned on the radio show. Reliance on any information provided by Focus on Females or others appearing on the show at the invitation of Focus on Females is solely at your own risk. Now, it's time for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. Here, we create clarity out of confusion and guide you through today's healthcare maze. Each week, we'll focus on a different medical topic with a guest expert answering your questions. Future topics and guests can be seen at www.focusonfemales.com. Call in between 12:30 and 1 p.m. on Sundays and present your case to our experts. To get involved with today's clinic, call now in Hillsboro, 289-1860, and everywhere else, 877-969-8600. Be proactive with your health. We're here to focus on you. And now, our host, Dr. Stephen Maskin.
The Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic is on, and we thank you for listening. Today, we're tackling myelodysplasia or pre-leukemia with guest expert Dr. Claudio Anicetti of the Moffitt Cancer Center. But first, this radio show and the free annual Focus on Females Women's Healthcare Symposium, now the largest in the country with 1,800 women, is supported by the not-for-profit Focus on Females Education Foundation, whose mission is to create an interactive, dynamic, community-based healthcare safety net, making you an expert on your personal medical needs. The result? Better partnering with your existing doctor, leading to more effective office visits, faster results, and a reduced economic burden of avoidable medical and emergency care. We save lives and protect families through health education. And everybody listening now, you should be well aware and advise your friends of our upcoming symposium almost 2 months away. March 27th is our fifth annual Focus on Females Women's Healthcare Symposium. Our keynote speaker is the President of USF, Dr. Judy Genshaft. Our MC and honorary chair is Stacy Scheibel, whom we all know as the News Channel 8 news anchor. And our topics, we have over 20 topics, including cardiac disease, colon cancer, cervical, ovarian, and uterine cancer, nutrition and cancer prevention, obesity in women, migraines and other headaches, fertility and family, menopause, bladder incontinence. We also have osteoporosis, sleep disorders, breast cancer, reversing dry eye, skin cancer, diabetes, allergies, and asthma, raising your child without going crazy, and screening for breast cancer. In addition, we also have a seminar available on financial wellness. So this is all one day. On Saturday, March 27th at the Tampa Convention Center, and it is entirely free. Again, 1,800 women last year. We hope to break 2,000 this year. In addition to all the seminars, we also have healthcare screenings, and we also have a fitness class, 8 different types of fitness classes, and chair massage. Again, all free for you. You can register. We recommend you registering online to be assured to reserve a seat in the seminars you are interested in. And the registration is at focusonfemales.com. And off the home page, on the upper tab, you can go right to the registration page and go ahead and reserve your seat. So we encourage you to do so, as well as to share with your friends, relatives, neighbors, coworkers, and so on. Okay, back to today. Today's radio show, as we said, on myelodysplasia. And I have the privilege of once again introducing Dr. Claudio Anicetti, who's the chairman of the Department of Blood and Marrow Transplantation at Moffitt Cancer Center and the professor of oncological services at the University of South Florida here in Tampa. Welcome, Claudio.
Good morning. It's my pleasure to be here, Sue.
And we some time ago, we did a show together on a complication of stem cell or blood stem cell transplantation, graft versus host, and it proved very helpful to those that participated in the show and called in with questions. So once again, we're very excited about today's show. Now, Claudio Anicetti earned a medical degree and trained in internal medicine at the School of Medicine at the University of Perugia in Italy. He completed a fellowship in pediatric immunology at the Children's Memorial Hospital in Oklahoma City and a fellowship in oncology in the Department of Medicine at the University of Washington and Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in Seattle, Washington. Board certified by the American Board of Internal Medicine with a subspecialty in medical oncology, Dr. Anicetti is the president of the American Society of Blood and Marrow Transplantation. He is a member of the Advisory Council in Blood Stem Cell Transplantation to the United States Secretary of Health and Human Services. He's also served as board member of the Center for International Blood and Marrow Transplant Research and the National Marrow Donor Program. Dr. Anicetti has published over 300 articles, reviews, and book chapters. He has been a member of the editorial boards for the journal Blood and currently serves on the editorial boards of Biology of Blood and Marrow Transplantation. He has been NIH-funded since 1989 for translational research in transplantation and has served as a reviewer of NIH study sections, experimental therapeutics, and clinical immunology and immunopathology. His research interests is in the control of graft-versus-host disease while sparing the anti-tumor response in mouse models and human transplants. Dr. Anicetti holds 2 patents. Okay, well, myelodysplasia, how common is it? Let's begin there. Well, let's go back, take a step back further. What is myelodysplasia?
Myelodysplasia is a cancer of the bone marrow where the cells that produce all the blood elements, the white, the red, and the platelets, no longer work properly because they're sickened. And so patients develop anemia, low white counts, so they're at risk for infections. They develop low platelets, so they're at risk for bleeding, and this disease may develop into leukemia.
Well, here's my first question. When I think of dysplasia of other parts of the body, like skin or my particular area of interest, the ocular surface, it's a single stem cell that's gone rogue or awry. Is it a single stem cell in the marrow, or is it multicentric, multiple stem cells not differentiating properly? Do we know?
Well, in the beginning, it's likely going to be a first stem cell, but as the disease evolved, there are multiple type of clones that have the disease itself, and they can be distinguished because of different chromosomal abnormalities.
Is it theoretically possible, if we were to identify the very earliest stages of myelodysplasia, that it may indeed derive from a single clone?
Yeah. Most of the diseases at the early stages have cytogenetic abnormalities with unique chromosomal abnormalities. The most common are those that have deletion of the long arm or chromosome 5 or deletion of chromosome 7 or trisomy 8. Others have more complex cytogenetic abnormalities, so are likely deriving multiple derived by multiple clones.
If it were, if we caught it at early stage, say for example, if there are a single clone, is there a way to identify that clone in the bone marrow with any kind of advanced technology?
Right. Right now, what we can do is take the marrow stem cell, the marrow cells out of the marrow with a marrow aspirate, and put them in the test tube and let them grow and look at the chromosome spreading, and that's called cytogenetic testing. And that's a test that's been developed almost 35, 40 years ago. But more sophisticated testing now looks at a specific probe for each chromosome or little segment of each chromosome with a test called fluorescence in situ hybridization, and that's much more sensitive because you can look at a spread of approximately 500 cells and don't even need to have the cell dividing to show up their chromosomes. But even if they're just sitting there, you can just identify what are the problems.
And these, is there any way to identify where in the marrow this clone exists? With some kind of, PET scan or some kind of similar visuals or imaging procedure. Is that possible at all? Or is that on the potentially future direction, potentially?
Well, it's possible that one day we'll develop technology to see that. At this time, our ability to diagnose myelodysplastic syndrome, it's actually limited to those cases that actually have the disease. And in order to have the disease must have spread throughout the whole bone marrow, because otherwise we wouldn't see suppression of the blood counts.
So, but there is, looking forward, ideally, I guess we would identify those people at risk, perhaps, and then initiate some kind of screening test. Is that potentially a futuristic approach?
Right, possibly. There are, first of all, myelodysplastic syndrome is a disease of the elderly. The median age of onset is around 75 years of age. And so, obviously, everything that damages the DNA, like X-rays, cosmic rays, chemotherapy, alkylating agents, benzene or other agents that damage the DNA, to which we are exposed through our lifetime, actually predisposed to this type of development that obviously increases in frequency as we go higher with age. The other possibility is that MDS, myelodysplastic syndrome, develops in patients that are exposed to chemotherapy. Also, there are some types of MDS that develops in families. And so knowing what the risk factors are and perhaps identifying risk factors much more in depth than we can say now, we'd be able to do frequent studies for specific markers and identify those patients early. Obviously, the science has to develop because right now the treatments that we have are not curative for MDS except for bone marrow transplantation. But perhaps even the treatments that we have now may be more effective if we were to catch the disease earlier.
Mm-hmm. I want to remind everybody out there who are listening to call in with your questions. That's 289-1860 in Hillsborough County. Once again, 289-1860. Everywhere outside of Hillsborough County, it's 877-969-8600. That's 877-969-8600. Any question at all on myelodysplastic syndrome or other blood cancers? Right here, we'll be right back with more on the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic.
This radio healthcare program is brought to you by the Focus on Females Education Foundation, a not-for-profit organization. Our mission is to make you an expert on your individual medical problems through dynamic and interactive educational programs. Real physicians answering real questions, speaking plain English, and giving practical, ready-to-use information on a wide variety of topics. Participation empowers families to better partner with their doctors. The result is more effective office visits, preventing unnecessary suffering, and eliminating the economic burdens of avoidable health and emergency care. We need your financial support. Donations to the foundation are tax deductible. Each and every dollar provides support so families can take control of their health. We have already saved and transformed lives for generations to come. Be a donor in what has been described as a phenomenon to reduce health illiteracy in our community. No donation is too small. To learn more about us and our free 5th Annual Women's Healthcare Symposium, March 27, 2010, visit www.focusonfemales.com. Donations can be made to Focus on Females Education Foundation, P.O. Box 320702, Tampa, Florida 33679-2702. Thank you.
Do your eyes have a foreign body sensation or are scratchy and sandy? Do they burn, sting, or itch, or are heavy and tired? Maybe your eyes are sensitive to light or your eyelids achy and sore. Have you seen countless doctors and still can't find relief? Have they told you, sorry, but you'll have to live with this and nothing can be done for you? Well, first, it's likely you suffer from dry eye. And second, don't stand for those answers anymore just because someone else doesn't understand your dry eye problems. Go to the only eye doctor in Central Florida that specializes exclusively in dry eye and related diseases. Meet with Dr. Stephen Maskin at the Dry Eye and Cornea Treatment Center, where you will be given up to 2 hours of face-to-face time with a doctor to get at the root cause of your dry eye pain, fluctuating vision, and redness, plus begin targeted therapy right away. Haven't you waited long enough?
Studio lines are open, so get focused, get involved, and get the advice you need for your health. In Hillsboro, 289-1860, and everywhere else, 877-969-8600. Once again, our host for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic, Dr. Stephen Maskin.
Okay, we're back with Dr. Claudio Anicetti from the Moffitt Cancer Center, and we're discussing myelodysplastic syndrome or pre-leukemia. Now, you mentioned, Claudio, how myelodysplastic syndrome increases with age because we're all exposed to x-rays. Does ultraviolet light come into play here too or not? Now, that's more of a surface cutaneous risk factor. Does prolonged sun exposure increase risk of any kind of a marrow disease? That we know.
I am not aware that that's the case. Obviously, sun exposure, UV lights, risk factor for melanomas, other skin cancers. I'm not aware that there is a correlation with MDS, but perhaps will be found one day.
Okay. But you also mentioned cosmic rays. So pilots, astronauts, perhaps, or?
I would think that every one of us actually flying up at 30,000 feet is going to be exposed to some level of X-rays that actually are going to be cumulatively in our life increasing our risk of leukemia, MDS, lymphoma, and other blood disorders and other types of cancers.
Well, that's very important. So someone who travels for a living that's constantly in the air 3, 4, 5 times a week, they clearly are at increased risk.
Right. And obviously the amount of X-ray that you need to develop in order to reach a level of risk is probably exceeding the average travel time of anyone that works in the airline industry. But obviously with so many people traveling, that's a risk factor that sometimes we ignore.
So, would you give any advice? Do you have any advice for people that are flying daily, several hours each day, or is there anything at all? Advice that we are giving people that are after 10, 20, 30 years in the air.
Well, I think that right now there are federal guidelines on how much people can actually be traveling and be exposed and. I think that's what we need to be sticking to, but it is obvious from everything's known there is some minimal amount of risk in that activity.
Okay, and the risk from the X-rays, the cosmic rays, benzene, chemicals, chemotherapy, is it considered cumulative?
Absolutely. I mean, I would expect that that's going to be the case. So, for example, if somebody is exposed to benzene and radiation at the same time, I would expect that the probability of developing leukemia or myelodysplastic syndrome is enormously higher than somebody is only exposed to one of them. And obviously, that's a function of the dose.
And is it known if these risk factors have a particular cell line that they impact over another? Or they all considered to impact the same cell lines, the the lymphoblast or the myelocyte or the...
Well, that's an interesting question. For example, survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki have the highest incidence of leukemia, myelodysplastic syndrome, and myeloma. Lymphoma doesn't appear to be as high of a risk factor for that disease.
So there may be something to that. Tell me about the stages of myelodysplastic syndrome.
For the myelodysplastic syndrome, it develops in the community, in which case for about two-thirds, there is no exposure to alkylating agents that have been used for cancer therapy before, and so very hard to identify a real cause. The disease may appear just as a suppression of the red cells, as anemia. And for those patients, we can use just drugs that actually boost the red cell production. For other patients, actually, the disease may present as more advanced, with no white cells, no platelets. And for those patients, usually the therapy is directed according to what the chromosomal abnormalities are. If there is a 5q-, a deletion of the long arm of chromosome 5, a new drug called Revlimid has been put on the market in the last 5 years and is actually quite effective inducing responses, about 75%. Some of them are quite durable.
And those are the 5q-, that is myelodysplastic syndrome?
Correct.
Okay. All right. So that's still a pre-leukemic stage.
Correct.
Okay.
And then patients have other type of chromosomal abnormalities but have, high-stage myelodysplastic syndrome. Then there are other drugs that have also been marketed in the last 5 years. One is called Vidaza. The other one is called Dacogen. The Vidaza appears to be improving survival of these patients.
So this is very exciting, then, that we are developing new pharmaceuticals for these for this disease. And so obviously then the key is, does the point at detection of this disease impact the survival? I'm talking about still pre-leukemic. In the pre-leukemic stages, does the point at which they're detected in that pre-leukemic stage impact the survival?
Randomized trials have shown that Vidaza can actually prolong survival. The prolongation of survival is in the order of 6 months to a year. So I would expect that somebody that developed the type of myelodysplastic syndrome, the response of Vidaza, treated early in the course of the disease, may actually get the most benefit, but this has not been shown as yet.
Okay.
Obviously, bone marrow transplant impacts the survivability, can cure the disease. Other drugs cannot yet, besides Vidaza that can prolong survival. And clearly, outcome after transplant is better for the disease in earlier course.
So how do you decide whether to go to pharmaceutical approach versus bone marrow transplant approach?
Well, right now, there are standardized guidelines that the physicians that treat myelodysplastic syndrome have actually agreed upon and published. Patients that have early stage disease, that just have anemia as the symptom that bothers them, lack of red cells and fatigue, they benefit from growth factor to stimulate red cells, and if they're very young, from immune suppressive therapy. Some of them from the Revlimid, if they have the deletion of the long arm of chromosome 5. But those other patients that have more advanced MDS, that have much shorter life expectancy, they benefit from more more aggressive therapy. The standard chemotherapy we use for acute leukemia doesn't work for myelodysplastic syndrome. There are hundreds or perhaps thousands of patients have been treated with that approach, and it's just shown it doesn't actually affect the disease, perhaps shorten survival. But transplant can actually cure the disease.
So let me restate that. With acute leukemia, the chemotherapy used for that does not significantly help the myelodysplastic syndrome.
That's correct.
Okay, well, we have another break. We'll be right back with more on the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. Once again, call in at 289-1860 outside of Hillsborough County, 877-969-8600. Be right back.
Talk Radio 860 WGUL.
Focus, focus, yeah, the focus.
You're as
freezing temperatures. It's not a game to Florida growers. And there's the threat of wildfires during the hot, dry months of spring ahead. Dr.
America's digital goddess, Kim Komando here. Cameras, camcorders, home electronics, HDTVs, computers, online security, privacy, Facebook, MySpace, Blu-ray, and MP3s. Phew, it's a good thing I'm so very gentle on your ears. If it's in your digital life, it's right here on your radio. After all, they don't call me America's digital goddess for nothing.
Kim Komando, Sunday afternoon at 2 on Talk Radio 860 WGUL.
This radio healthcare program is brought to you by the Focus on Females Education Foundation, a not-for-profit organization. Our mission is to make you an expert on your individual medical problems through dynamic and interactive educational programs. Real physicians answering real questions, speaking plain English, and giving practical, ready-to-use information on a wide variety of topics. Participation empowers families to better partner with their doctors. The result is more effective office visits, preventing unnecessary suffering, and eliminating the economic burdens of avoidable health and emergency care. We need your financial support. Donations to the foundation are tax deductible. Each and every dollar provides support so families can take control of their health. We have already saved and transformed lives for generations to come. Be a donor in what has been described as a phenomenon to reduce health illiteracy in our community. No donation is too small. To learn more about us and our free 5th Annual Women's Healthcare Symposium, March 27, 2010, visit www.focusonfemales.com. Donations can be made to Focus on Females Education Foundation, P.O. Box 320702, Tampa, Florida 33679-2702. Thank you. Your host for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic is ophthalmologist and eye surgeon, Dr. Stephen L. Maskin. Dr. Maskin is the medical director of the Dry Eye and Cornea Treatment Center, the proud sponsor of today's show. At the Dry Eye and Cornea Treatment Center, Dr. Maskin specializes in solving difficult dry eye and cornea disorders with patients traveling from over 35 states and 5 continents for his evaluation. Dr. Maskin manages these dry eye disorders using innovative medical and surgical therapies, including the use of placenta-derived amniotic membrane, a new patent-pending natural eye lubricant to provide relief for dry eye sufferers, an exciting new procedure to unblock obstructed tear glands, and a topical cure for eye surface cancer. Dr. Maskin has been successfully managing difficult dry eye cases for over 20 years and is board-certified, fellowship-trained, and a fellow of the American College of Surgeons and American Academy of Ophthalmology. He's been selected a best doctor in America every year from 2000 through 2009 and as an America's top ophthalmologist by Consumers Research Council of America. We hope the Focus on Females education programs, including this show, will help you and your family find the health care that works for you. Focus on Females believes in saving lives and protecting families. And please, visit drmaskin.com, and if you have not found relief for your painful red dry eyes, come in to see Dr. Maskin at the Dry Eye and Cornea Treatment Center, where comfortable eyes lead to restored lives.
Studio lines are open, so get focused, get involved, and get the advice you need for your health. In Hillsboro, 289-1860, and everywhere else, 877-969-8600. Once again, our host for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic, Dr. Stephen Maskin.
Welcome back to the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. Today we're tackling pre-leukemia, also known as myelodysplastic syndrome, with the chief of the Department of Blood and Marrow Transplantation at Moffitt Cancer Center, Dr. Claudio Anicetti. And we've talked so far about what is myelodysplasia, the risk factors, and really we're all potentially exposed to risk factors through x-rays. And, of course, some of us who have received chemotherapy, alkylating agents are yet increased risk. But again, as we age, we all are at risk. What would you say, what's the epidemiology, did you say, of myelodysplastic syndrome?
There are about 10,000 cases of myelodysplastic syndrome diagnosed every year in the United States. 75% of them are in patients over the age of 65.
Okay.
And about half over the age of 75.
Okay. All right. And How long is the disease course? And you mentioned, we started talking about the stages of MDS, we talked about the early stages and a couple of therapies that are available. How many stages are there of MDS?
Well, I would say in a very simplistic manner, there are three stages. The first stage, we call it early MDS, and by the compromise and the black counts, the involvement of the chromosome, the number of leukemia cells in the bone marrow, we call it either early or advanced. And then, obviously, the ultimate stage of MDS is transformation into acute leukemia.
Okay. All right. And we talked a little bit about some of the medications available for early. How about advanced?
For advanced disease, patients can get treated with Vidaza, Dacogen, a few of them with Revlimid, or with bone marrow transplant.
Okay, so the same medications are available for advanced, but also then the consideration for the bone marrow transplantation becomes important. What are some of the toxicities of these medications?
I would say that the Vidaza and Dacogen, both of them suppress blood counts, and so patients may have even more symptoms from anemia and at risk for infection or bleeding. But obviously they are supported by the physicians that treat them with antibiotic blood transfusions. In general, these treatments are very well tolerated and are associated with very low risk.
And they're given orally?
No, Revlimid is an oral drug, but is mostly used for early stage disease. Very few patients with advanced stage disease have only the chromosome 5 long arm deletion that is mostly a response element for Revlimid. A few other patients respond to Revlimid, but not many of them. That's not first line for those.
Okay, and the Vidaza is a IV?
Both Vidaza and Dacogen can be either subcutaneous or intravenous. So.
All right. And do they have any liver or kidney toxicity that we know of?
I would say that there are kidney function limitations. So if somebody has kidney dysfunction, it's very hard to treat them with this type of drugs if this kidney dysfunction is severe. But otherwise, there is no substantial liver or kidney toxicity, mostly marrow toxicity.
Okay.
And gastrointestinal toxicity, there is some nausea, vomiting, diarrhea.
Okay. Okay, so at some point then, bone marrow transplantation is considered. And on a break, you mentioned that bone marrow transplantation is quite successful.
Bone marrow transplantation should be considered for any patient with a high-risk disease that could be a candidate, according to the guidelines developed by physicians that actually treat myelodysplastic syndrome. And such patients could be up to age 75, but have to be in good health otherwise, not having life-threatening cardiac, lung, or renal disease, or liver disease. So their organ function must be otherwise well. They don't need to have life-threatening infections because otherwise transplant is very, very risky. So basically about a third of the patients are candidate for transplant once they've been diagnosed with myelodysplastic syndrome. And then they need to find a donor. Some of them have a match within the family. Most of them will find a match within unrelated volunteer or cord blood.
Okay. So that seems to not be a limiting issue in most cases, finding a donor.
That is right. Right now, the chance that a sibling will be a match to us is 25%. But once we go into the registry, the average chance of finding a full match is in the order of about 50 to 60%. It varies according to ethnic groups because the gene that we need to match for transplant are related to the ethnicity of the patients. So for some, it's a little higher than the other. But if we allow some degree of mismatch, we currently find a donor for up to 85% of people. Plus, considering the sibling transplant, it gets up to 90, And then if we can allow cord blood that is more tolerant of the disparity, then probably 95, 97% of patients can get a transplant.
And when you say cord blood, those are, that's cord blood of could you describe that?
Yep. when babies are born, many programs in the nation are set up, in the world, are set up to actually collect the placental blood that is expressed out of the cord into a test, into a tube. Sometimes 50 or 80 cc of blood is expressed out and before the cord is ligated, and then the cord is ligated, and so the, all the product is basically a leftover product, and that's tested with a variety of means, sure it is safe, and then cryopreserved in banks around the world. There are now approximately 200 to 250,000 cord blood from unrelated babies that have donated the cords, so it's mother's signed consent, and those cords are available for transplant of patients if they don't have any better match.
Okay, so that's very interesting. So you can use the cord blood as a donor, even though it's not your own cord blood.
Obviously. Correct.
Okay, and that cord blood is considered stem cells in that cord blood, I imagine.
Absolutely, the cord blood is very rich of stem cells, and although when we count them with the numbers that we, with the tests that we have, appears to be very few, they're actually very, very much the true stem cells, the few that we count, and so they're able to graft.
And because there's undifferentiated stem cells, then the risk of rejection is low.
Well, with transplant of cord blood, the risk of the body of the patient rejecting the cord is actually depending on the dose of cells in the cord. So if the dose is small, the risk of rejection is high. And so what we have learned to do for a transplant of adults that are relatively large compared to the small cord units, we use two cords. Mm. And now specific protocols are investigating how to deal with those cord blood cells. And so we can, in this way, transplant adults. The other reaction, though, the cord immune cells could affect the body of the recipient with a reaction called graft versus host disease. And in that case, using the cord, this reaction is much weaker than using blood stem cells from an unrelated volunteer adult donor.
In which case, the cells are more mature, the immune cells are more mature, and therefore more active?
We don't really understand why the graft versus host disease is weaker with a cord. There are lots of hypotheses. Probably is immaturity or lack of experience, so they adapt faster, so to speak. But these are very much primitive hypotheses. We don't have a very much detailed scientific understanding, but that's what happens.
And so with that, what are some of the risks of a bone marrow transplant?
Well, first of all, the highest probability of treatment failure is that the disease will come back. So the transplant may be successful in terms of engraftment, but then not effective in treatment of the underlying disease. That's a major risk, actually, of doing the procedure. But then there are other risks. One is that the transplant could be rejected. That's usually very small. The other risk is the transplant could try to reject the body. That's the most substantial risk of transplant complication that we have now. So the patient may be cured, may actually die of that type of transplant complication. And once that reaction goes on, then infections usually are the problem.
We just talked about how with a cord transplants, the incidence or the nature of the graft-versus-host disease is less aggressive. Have you come to a point when some patients that have had aggressive graft-versus-host reactions to start over with a cord donor? Does that make sense to consider?
So it could be an alternative, but it doesn't quite work well for treatment when somebody has very advanced graft versus host disease. It's very hard to do another transplant, so to speak. So what we're learning more and more now is actually to treat it, to prevent it and treat it.
And how is progress on that?
Well, there is quite a bit of progress because there are a number of procedures and drugs that actually treat graft-versus-host disease. We now have a number of drugs that block different activation pathways, including tacrolimus, including CellCept, including rapamune, that is extremely effective, and then obviously glucocorticoids can shut off their reaction. And then what we can do is for the therapy, treat the blood of the recipients with a UVA light after the blood has been treated with a substance that makes the lymphocytes susceptible to those UV lights. And so basically that shuts down the GVHD quite effectively.
Is that called photopheresis?
Photopheresis.
And how frequently do you have to do that procedure? How frequently is it used?
Well, it obviously varies according to the incidence of graft-versus-host disease with each practice. And I would say in my own practice, I use it approximately 2-3% of the times.
Okay. All right. We talked before about indications, or at least what type of patient is qualified to receive a transplant, and about the requirement for basically healthy organs. Lack of infection, and actually up to 75 years of age. So has that increased over the last 10 years or so?
Yeah, until approximately 1998, we really were not daring to do transplants in patients over age of 60. In most centers, we're not transplanting patients over age of 50. But we've learned to do transplants using conditioning therapies that are much more suitable to older people and more fragile people. And therefore, we can treat patients that have concomitant comorbidities that are low level, and the treatments are actually more gentle and can actually be delivered successfully to fight the disease without offending the patient itself. And so right now, if patients have an underlying good, strong condition, we can transplant them up to the age of 70. And I would say that with these new therapies, we don't see a lot of, we don't actually appreciate the difference in age on outcome once we're looking at patients that are age 45 up to the age of 65 or 70.
Wow, that's outstanding. Does the age of the donor make a difference in the success of the transplant?
Yes, both in sibling studies and in unrelated donor volunteer studies, it's been shown that the younger the donor, the better the survival of the recipient. So obviously, if you take it to the extreme, cord blood transplants should have the most success if we were able to give enough cells for transplant, I'm sure that they take.
Wow, very good. The conditioning therapies, would you discuss a few of the conditioning therapies to give our listeners an idea of what the approach that's used to enable the older population of patients to have a successful outcome?
The most classical regimen before the year 2000 was a high dose of body radiation and high dose cyclophosphamide, which is an inoculating agent. And so patients that are in the age 20 tolerate that regimen extremely well. The patients that are over age of 40 do not. For patients over age of 40, regimens that use chemotherapy alone, a very, very low dose of radiation, have developed. Nowadays, at the Moffitt, we're using a regimen of fludarabine that is used to suppress the immune system and somewhat facilitate the anti-tumor effect of busulfan. The other drug is busulfan that actually is very effective against myelodysplastic syndrome cells. So these two agents together are given over 4 days, one injection each every day for 4 days, and the regimen causes drop in blood counts, falling hair, and sore throat. And most of these symptoms, except for the hair, resolve by about 3 weeks after transplant, and the hair usually comes back at about 6 months after transplant. The mortality of this procedure now is in the order of 1-2%.
Outstanding. Okay, we'll be back with more on the Focus on Females Radio Health Care Clinic. Once again, call in now with your questions, 289-1860 in Hillsborough County. Everywhere else, 877-969-8600. Be right back.
This radio healthcare program is brought to you by the Focus on Females Education Foundation, a not-for-profit organization. Our mission is to make you an expert on your individual medical problems through dynamic and interactive educational programs. Real physicians answering real questions, speaking plain English, and giving practical, ready-to-use information on a wide variety of topics. Participation empowers families to better partner with their doctors. The result is more effective office visits, preventing unnecessary suffering, and eliminating the economic burdens of avoidable health and emergency care. We need your financial support. Donations to the foundation are tax deductible. Each and every dollar provides support so families can take control of their health. We have already saved and transformed lives for generations to come. Be a donor in what has been described as a phenomenon to reduce health illiteracy in our community. No donation is too small. To learn more about us and our free 5th Annual Women's Healthcare Symposium, March 27, 2010, visit www.focusonfemales.com. Donations can be made to Focus on Females Education Foundation, P.O. Box 320702, Tampa, Florida 33679-2702. Thank you. Confused about dry eye? Not getting answers as to why your eyes are so red and painful and your blurry vision that gets a little better with a good blink? Now you can learn all about dry eye, the causes, treatments, and home remedies from the number one best-selling consumer book on dry eye problems, Reversing Dry Eye Syndrome by Dr. Stephen Maskin. Published by Yale University Press, Reversing Dry Eye Syndrome has been selected as a 2008 Best Book of the Year by the Association of American University Presses and a 2007 Best Consumer Health Book by Library Journal. Find answers for your dry eye. Go to your bookstore and pick up a copy of Reversing Dry Eye. You'll be glad you did.
Studio lines are open, so get focused, get involved, and get the advice you need for your health. In Hillsborough, 289-1860, and everywhere else, 877-969-8600. Once again, our host for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic, Dr. Stephen Maskin.
Okay, welcome back to Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. I'm with Dr. Claudio Anicetti, the chair of the Department of Blood and Marrow Transplantation at the Moffitt Cancer Center. And Claudio, I want to ask you one question about the quality of the patient's life after transplant. How would you describe that?
In the first month, patients are recovering from the chemotherapy, and so that's very much compromised by that. They get out of the hospital about 3 weeks, and the last 10 days they continue to improve. At about 3 months, they're able to leave the transplant center, and at that point on, most of them actually start to do some part-time job. If they have office job, most live from home office, they could probably do occupation for about 4 hours. At about 6 months, we recommend most of our patients to go back to work. And with these new regimens we're using nowadays, actually, they can do that. At about a year, 80 to 90% of our patients have a normal lifestyle, although about 80% of them still are on many medication they need to take. They need to have at least a monthly checkup. And they're still at risk for post-transplant complication. Their life is really not completely recovered based on many studies that have been done in quality of life of patients until about 3 to 5 years after transplant.
So at 3 to 5 years after transplant, how many medications does a successful case patient have to use on a daily basis?
At 5 years after transplant, very few are still on medications. I would say 10 to 20%, very low doses of medications that control the immune system, and 95% of them have a normal lifestyle.
Wow.
or score themselves as having a normal lifestyle.
Right. Okay. Excellent. Of course, that's important. The educational component of this must be very, very important, to educate the patient as to what to expect.
Absolutely, and that's just very hard. Patients usually that have blood disorders are usually hit now, and very quickly they need to learn about all the different modality of treatments, including transplants, and when they're referred, there's just never enough time to actually grasp everything. And so it's a continuous learning and improvement and understanding what the transplant is about and how to adjust to the post-transplant therapies and events.
Mm. And tell me about Moffitt Cancer Center. Moffitt, of course, is a leader in bone marrow transplantation. Moffitt's in the top 10, isn't it, in the country?
By size, we are currently probably number 6 or 7 in the nation, certainly within the top 10. It's very hard to get statistics because there is not a unified American registry by procedures. But obviously, the Moffitt hematology and transplant programs are so strong together because of the development of the last 5 years with Alan List, Eduardo Sotomayor, and I, and many other faculty that we are recruiting new.
And now Moffitt itself, you said you came on how many years ago? Five and a half years ago. And Moffitt itself is, how old is an institution?
21 year old.
So this is quite amazing, just to chart its growth. Claudio, last thoughts for our listeners on myelodysplastic syndrome.
I would say that you have a disease that is extremely rare and that you need to seek treatment in specialized center. Standard of care treatments for early disease or even advanced disease work for very few patients, and so clinical trials are extremely important for the development of treatments in this disease and for your potential benefit. And obviously, if you have advanced disease, you should seek the option of transplant and counseling about transplant as soon as possible.
And there certainly is progress from the therapeutic perspective, significant progress with
the last 10 years, we've seen that transplants completely revolutionized the way that we use stem cells. We were using bone marrow before, now we use peripheral blood from donors or cord blood. And the way we give conditioning therapy, all the antibiotics we have, we didn't have anything for molds that were killing our patients, and now very few patients actually die from that. From what is considered the therapy for MDS itself, three drugs have been approved in the last 6 years alone, Revlimid, Dacogen, and Vidaza, that have changed the quality of life of our patients and life expectancy as well.
Outstanding. I'd like to thank my good friend Claudio Anastetti for joining us today on the topic of myelodysplasia. Next Sunday on the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic, we'll be joined with Dr. Bent Herwig in discussing tachycardia or rapid heart rate. In the meantime, this is Dr. Steve Maskin wishing each and every one of you a warm week and a wonderful week, and we'll see you next Sunday on the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. Bye-bye.
The Focus on Females Healthcare Education programs are for you. Visit our free 5th annual Focus on Females Women's Healthcare Symposium, March 27th, 2010, at the Tampa Convention Center, and every Sunday from 1 to 2 p.m. for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic on Talk Radio 860 WGUL.